What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Maloela Maliaho Eki Mwelele Aitahakotoa. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you live from Nuku'alofa, the Kingdom of Tonga. I'm your host, Marianne Kupu, privileged to be spending this time with you this morning. Today on the show, tribal fighting in PNG's highlands prevents the burial of 21 people who were killed.
Where the landslide took place, that's where the funeral was. The bodies haven't reached there, at their own village.
That and more here on Pacific Beat. But let's start with Samoa, as Toa Samoa prepares to take on New Zealand in the Pacific Rugby League Championship. Fans across the world will be celebrating with Samoan flags and the famous parades. That is, everywhere except in Samoa. Samoa police have announced no permits will be issued for pre-game parades, citing safety concerns. The decision has left many local supporters disappointed. The ABC's Samoa reporter, Adele Fruin, has the story.
It's a famous sight. Samoans in their cars waving their flags, fans screaming and cheering on the sidelines. But this weekend, the police want the streets to be empty. And in the capital, Apia, there's mixed views.
There's no reason permits should be denied. Parades are how our people show support for Toa Samoa ahead of their upcoming game.
If Toa Samoa wins, I'll join and support any parade, even if it's banned by police.
Parades have both positive and negative sides. Sadly, as we have seen and witnessed, some have misused them, leading to people being harmed.
Acting Samoa Police Commissioner Leataua Samuelu Afamasanga told local media that no parade permits will be issued prior to this weekend's Toa Samoa game because of safety concerns.
Approved parades follow the proper process. Organisers file requests, meet with us and receive safety guidelines and legal requirements to protect the public and ensure compliance with the law.
He says organisers were warned of the ongoing safety concerns, but they weren't followed.
As a result, we've decided to stop issuing parade permits.
He added a parade on Sunday was held without a permit, with two injuries linked to it. However, parade organiser Agnes Skelton-Early says incidents from the unpermitted parade should not be blamed on them.
We followed all parade guidelines. The issues raised happened on Sunday when we did not request any permits. Our only approved parade was Saturday from 5 to 6pm, so there's no reason to make a fuss or ban future parades.
Mrs. Early says she understands the police perspective, but believes authorities should target troublemakers and lawbreakers instead of blaming those who follow guidelines. Despite the police ban, her team will request permission from the police commissioner to parade outside the town area, celebrating what she hopes will be a Toa Samoa victory.
If our team wins, we plan to celebrate with a barbecue and fun activities for the kids.
That was a report by Adele Fruin from Samoa. Now, Now, a week after a landslide killed 21 people in PNG's mountainous highlands, tribal fighting is preventing their bodies from being taken home to for burial. The early morning landslide buried the house where they were sleeping in Kuka's village in Enga province. The victims are from a neighboring village and had come to Kuka's to vote in local government elections. Local teacher Simon Tumu says that the same tribal fight that forced them to leave home to vote is now preventing the return of their bodies.
The relatives of the victims brought the bodies up to where the landslide took place. That's where the funeral was. A temporary funeral, let me say that way, because the bodies haven't reached their own village, which is another 5 kilometers away from where the landslide took place. As I said last time, they only came to reside as visitors in their relative's place, and that is how they encountered that fate. But at the moment, when they're trying to take the bodies to the village, but then as I said, the link, the only access that they're supposed to travel to by vehicles is temporarily kind of not operational because of a big fight is going on in that area, and I'm hearing rumors that that these people may not be allowed to access that place. And they, when I returned from Agen, I saw that there was a big crowd. There was a big crowd at the place where the landslide took place, and where the people, where the bodies have been brought up from the morgue. And they are there, and then people from there even saying that the bodies will not be flown, will not be taken to the village, but I don't know how they are going to. They probably take shortcuts through. Shortcuts through walking is possible because it's quite close. But they are supposed to go in a vehicle. But that is that seems another frustrating hurdle for them.
So this passage that they are supposed to go through, are you able to tell us a little bit more about it? Is it a current war zone area?
The road is from Wapimanda through to Mambisana Rural Hospital, and then it's supposed to go to a place called Lowalai. And before reaching the destination of the victims, the fight is taking place along the road and just about another just there. And that is that's the only access link, and that is where the people are. The enemies are fighting on the road, are exchanging gunshots. It is risky for them to go through this.
Is there enough security on ground to at least guarantee some safety for this repatriation?
That I'm not quite sure. If the relatives of the victims can negotiate with the security personnel, there are a lot of security personnel around the fighting area. Securing the hospital, even though all the staff houses are burnt, the administration building together with the hospital itself is there, and many of the security personnel, DF and policemen, are on the ground looking after that area. But I, for one, wouldn't know whether they are making some kind of arrangements like that, so that the people, the policemen or the security personnel who are there can inform these two wearing tribe that there's something like this, and we are trying to take these bodies over to their village. Or would you please retreat for a while or something like that?
That was teacher Simon Tumu speaking there to Belinda Cora. A first kind of its kind study likened the waste discharge from deep sea mining operation to junk food for the marine life in the impact zones. The research from the University of Hawaii drew on data gathered from the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, or CCZ, an area of the Pacific Ocean which has drawn interest from mining companies because its seabed is covered in nodules rich in valuable metals. Co-author Brian Pope, a professor of earth sciences and expert in marine stable isotope biogeochemistry, told Lucy Cooper, companies put vehicles on the seafloor to collect nodules, but it's the waste from mining operation which could have an adverse impact on marine life.
They will either scrape up or suck up the nodules, but there's also seawater that comes up with that and sediment. And that goes up 4.5 kilometers to a ship where the nodules are separated from everything else. Now, they have to put that water back, otherwise the ship's going to sink because it takes on too much water. So they return it to the seafloor, and it was proposed, at least by some, to return it at 1,250 meters, so just over a kilometer under the seafloor, or under the sea surface. And we wanted to know what animals were there, what they ate, and, you know, how they made a living. We also wanted to know the size of particles that they obtained their nutrition from. And we were focused on understanding how, in particular, particles would impact the base of that food web. Would they simply dilute the natural particles that were there? And did that have a detrimental effect on the animals that live at those depths?
And what did you find?
What we found is that, yes, they indeed did. The particles that the small animals that live at those depths that eat those particles directly, the mine waste would displace them with particles that have very, very low nutrition. So it's kind of like dumping junk food into the ocean and diluting the natural food that's present there.
What was the motivation behind this study for yourself and the other researchers?
For us, we've been studying this area of the ocean through research grants from a number of sources, mainly the National Science Foundation. And for us, it was nirvana. We could go to this area of the ocean that's really difficult to get to. It turned out that there was another purpose to it that also addressed potential economic and environmental impacts of mining.
The study found that waste discharge from deep sea mining operations in the Clarion-Clipperton zone could disrupt marine life in that midwater twilight zone that you mentioned, that area between 200 to 1500 metres below sea level. It specifically found that 53% of all zooplankton and 60% of micronecton, which feed on zooplankton, would be impacted by the discharge. How does this kind of impact on these teeny tiny, you know, kind of animals and basic food building blocks impact, say, something that the rest of the world would think about in terms of a whale or a dolphin or a seal, say?
The zooplankton are tiny. They're microscopic. But they're the ones that sit very near the base of the food web throughout the ocean. They're feeding on particles, and it's those particles that are being released by mining that we believe will impact the zooplankton diet. Because the particles they're releasing are very, very low in nutrients. And then their food, the zooplankton are food for the micronecton. But the micronecton, they also are part of the food web, and they get eaten by the kinds of animals that we care about, whether they're charismatic macrofauna like whales or other cetaceans, or whether they're a commercial fish that we like to see eventually upon our dinner plate. So they are... they're an integral link to the animals that we really care about because those animals can dive down to those depths to get their dinner, the micronecton.
How do you hope this study will influence, say, the International Seabed Authorities or the United States National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's decision-making?
Well, we hope that they will realize that You know, the decisions they're making should be based on science. That seems to be a novel concept now in the United States, use science to make decisions like this. But we hope that our findings will allow policymakers and others to help identify what needs to be monitored and what needs to be studied more.
That was Brian Pope, a professor of earth sciences at the University of Hawaii, an expert in marine stable isotope biogeochemistry.
Hold the front page!
Well, it's that time to take a look at what's making headline around the region. And to do that, I'm joined with producer Carl Evans. Malolele, Carl, how are you?
I'm well, Marion. It's been a while. You've had a few adventures recently, I understand.
Yes, very adventurous and a very long holiday for me, and I'm happy to be back.
Oh, well, it's good to hear your voice again.
Yes, well, it's good to be back. Well, let's get right into it. Well, the U.S. Air Force has conducted a test-launch intercontinental ballistic missile in the Marshall Islands. What are more information regarding this?
Yeah, it's a bit of a concerning story, this one, Marion. So it was virtually this time last week, I reported on NewsWrap, actually, that U.S. President Donald Trump had urged military leaders to restart nuclear weapons testing. And it looks like the first one has already been carried out, with the Air Force firing an intercontinental ballistic missile from California into the Pacific. So it flew more than 4,200 miles, landing at a test site at Kwajalein Atoll in the Marshall Islands, where from there, scientists performed sort of analyzed its data. Luckily, the missile was unarmed, so it wasn't a nuclear bomb that was sent over, obviously. So it was just a flight test. However, it's a missile. The missile that they tested is a missile that's capable of having a nuclear bomb attached to it. So, in a way, it's in some ways the facilitator of the devastation that a bomb like that would bring. So, it has drawn a lot of attention, particularly after Trump's order last week. And it's something that's really deepened a lot of regional anxiety within the Pacific as well, just given that dark history of testing within the Marshall Islands. So, yeah, it looks like we've got more tests coming our way.
Well, hopefully we'll hear more update on that story. But let's head on to Samoa, some very excited and happy Samoan that will be traveling to New Zealand soon and that could have access to a 3-month visitor's visa upon arrival.
Yes, Samoans travelling to New Zealand could soon have access to 3-month visas. So the deadline on a petition which was advocating for visa-free travel for Samoans expires today after it garnered more than 30,000 signatures when it was put forward way back in February by former National MP N.A. Arthur. So basically, the petition calls for Pacific citizens entering New Zealand to receive a 3-month visa upon arrival. It's the same arrangement that's afforded to travellers from 60 other countries around the world. So this would essentially bring the travel policy in line with what people from other countries receive and really sort of levelling that playing field, so to speak. So as of now, the Samoan Prime Minister is currently in New Zealand for medical treatment, and he's publicly backed the petition as well, saying he's going to take up the matter with the New Zealand government.
Well, that's great news. Kyle, this morning I've got how many chat messages sending me the link to the petition. So even all the Tongans here in Tonga are also, and I'm pretty sure, have all signed up for that petition. But let's head on to Port Moresby. A betel nut shortage in Port Moresby has seen prices surge. How is that possible?
Yeah, that's right, Marion. So according to the national newspaper, prices have risen to between 300 kina and 400 kina per bag of betel nut. So most betel nut chewers in the city spend an average of, say, 20 kina per day, which equates to about 140 kina over the course of a week. So to put this into perspective, prices have essentially doubled due to that shortage of supply. As for why there's a shortage, it's still a little bit unclear. However, the shortage has been confirmed by suppliers. But there might be other factors driving up the prices as well, such as road and weather conditions. That also seems to have impacted supply. So, look, there's a few unanswered questions, but what we do know is, Marion, is that vendors are doing it tough and people are paying a premium on betel nut at the moment.
Yeah, in relation to tonga, our kava prices have gone up, and we don't know why has it gone up. I think it's just a demand from the Tongans living overseas, but that's something to look forward to and to dig into to find out more. But finally, we heard earlier about the Pacific Championship, but there's an injury to a key player.
Yeah, that's right. Jeremiah Nene, who played so well in their last game, has been ruled out of Sunday's Pacific Cup final with a shoulder injury. So he'll be replaced by Jaden Sue, who missed last month's win over Tonga due to a concussion. Meanwhile, Ata Ariota will also be in the mix to return from a head knock, and he's been named as the 18th man for Samoa for the final. So hopefully he gets a bit of a run on the field. But look, it's going to be a huge game. Will you be watching, Marion?
I don't think so. Tonga's not playing.
Oh, fair enough. No regional friendships when it comes to football, I understand. No, that's totally fair enough.
Yes, but thank you very much, Malo Alpito Carl, for updating us here on Pacific Beat.
Thank you, Marion.
In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favourite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the eras to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
In the Fale, Friday afternoons at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
It has been nearly three decades since the signing of the Noumea Accord, a promise by the French Republic to grant increased political power to New Caledonia and its indigenous Kanaki people. But a recent report by the People's Mission reveals the French Pacific Territory still remains in a fragile state of transition. According to the report, political trust has collapsed even after efforts to rebuild unity after last year's riots. So will this report somehow help shift the current crisis? One who is at the helm of this discussion is the People's Mission head, Anna Naupa, Pacific Policy and Development Specialist. Welcome to Pacific Beat, Anna.
Good morning, Marianne. Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's a pleasure to have you here. But before we get into the report, how would you describe the current political and social state of New Caledonia?
Thanks, Marianne. And I just want to preface before I speak, and good morning to all the listeners as well. You know, when the mission took place, we were invited in April this year. We were invited through the Église Protestante de Kanaki Nouvelle-Calédonie. That's the Protestant church in New Caledonia. And it was through a partnership with the PCC and the Pacific Network and Globalization. And I wanted to start with this point because we were there to listen to the communities and the people. Often when we hear about the processes and the situation around Kanaki New Caledonia, naturally we look to the politics and the political processes, as your question has asked. But we were there at the invitation of the people to come and listen to their stories and their experiences, because that point that you mentioned around political trust collapsing was being lived and felt in the day-to-day lives of many of the most poor in New Caledonia.
Well, the French territory had the Noumea Accord, then came along the Bougainville Accord. Has this effectively given Kanaki people more hope of self?
So in terms of the mission, when we spoke with the people, as the mission report says, as you've noted, because of the trust, the political trust having collapsed post-third referendum, in New Caledonia, the efforts to build reconciliation and find a more meaningful political process that is transparent, that is inclusive, and that promotes and safeguards forms of peace within the very struggling country. Those are really important. And so it is very encouraging to see that the leaders within Kanaki New Caledonia are finding a way through what has been such a difficult time with the Bougival Accord. Of course, that does not mean it's a perfect process. And this is why the mission report has really made a very important point that we here in the Pacific, we also need to be supporting and showing our solidarity and demanding transparent approaches. And so very much as part of an accountability in terms of decolonization processes, and we need to be demanding that these are impartial processes, because as communities were repeating to us throughout the mission, they said, you know, the decolonization process, it's not impartial, because France is playing a dual role as being both an administrator and arbiter of a process. And they said, we need to have neutral mediation. And this is where we in the Pacific, whether it's through the Pacific Islands Forum, whether it's through the Melanesian Spearhead Group, we have a part to play in showing our Pacific solidarity, strengthening it, and not leaving Kanaki New Caledonia communities without that support from regional mechanisms.
And I can hear your pet from the background. I'm sure it wants to bark and have a comment of its own. But from what
far away, I don't. That's what he is.
Well, from far, from what you're saying, the collapse of political trust has made it harder for France and the Pacific leaders to re-establish credible dialogue. How then can they genuinely include Kanak's perspective in shaping the territory's future?
Yes, yeah, so in terms of the political processes, these absolutely at the first step have to be determined by the people of Kanaki themselves. Our role here in the Pacific is to, and we have multiple types of roles. I mentioned the Pacific Islands Forum, the MSG, that they have play an important role in terms of, you know, potentially having an ongoing monitoring mechanism, facilitating inclusive dialogue. We had the Pacific Islands Forum Troika visit last year. To Kanaki New Caledonia. So these mechanisms are really important for showing what we can do from the Pacific. Fundamentally, the decision has to come from those who are asking for their right to self-determination. And what we can do is to support them in their processes. That said, I do make the mission really noted, and it's really interesting to see, you know, we're in November 2025 now, and yes. The Troika Plus mission was about a year ago. Our Pacific People's mission was in April this year, and we've just had the recent 16 October UN Committee of 24 on Decolonization resolution around Kanaki, which is very encouraging. But at the UNGA, the Annual General Assembly in September this year, when there was a recent article by Dev Policy, a good one that summarised all the issues that our Pacific countries raised. And when it came to Kanaki and this issue in this very tense political period and deepening socioeconomic inequalities within Kanaki New Caledonia, when it came to raising that in the world's highest platform at the UNGA, only one Pacific country raised it. And that country was Vanuatu. And
kudos
so,
to Vanuatu.
And oh yeah, I'm very proud of my country. Thank you. But so that's a very important message for all our listeners and our Pacific people to say we need our governments and our civil society, our faith communities, to all lend and lean into the solidarity that the situation in Kanaki is asking for.
Wow. And I thank you for that. But you said, and I quote, France cannot act as both referee and participant in the decolonization process. What did you mean by this?
Yes, yeah, the repeated refrain, particularly around this matter, has been that France has been regularly said this is a domestic matter. It is something that is internal to our country. But decolonization is a universal matter. Except for your beautiful kingdom of Tonga, you haven't had to go through the process. Many of us, most of us in the Pacific have. And that process of decolonization, even if we look at my own country and our own history around France and and Great Britain, having that regional solidarity, having the space to have neutral mediators, neutral observers to come in and watch the process, to hold all parties to account in what they've agreed, that is part of a decolonization process. And so with statements that it's an internal matter, a domestic matter only for France, then France is playing both the role of an actor who has very specific interests, as well as a mediator. And you cannot play both roles when you are talking about decolonization and the right to self-determination.
Yes, it's true what you just mentioned with us here in Tonga. We just celebrated 150th anniversary of our constitution here in Tonga, and we're very proud that we do not and have not experienced what you're going through in your country, in your patch. So going back to this report, what will help shift the current crisis with the report that you have already published?
Yeah. So as a Pacific People's Mission, our interest was first and foremost the impact to communities. And because we were there through the PCC and the UKPNC, that the faith-based communities and how we can link more across also linguistic lines, the English-speaking Pacific. We don't often engage as much as we should with our French-speaking brothers and sisters. So we looked, we encouraged through the mission, and we heard very strongly this call from across all who we spoke with, that they want to see us more in their country. They want to be with us more and to collaborate on many, many areas, whether it's things such as a trade in food items, or looking at how, weaving networks. For a lot of women, there's a big revival movement to try and restore the pandanus weaving across the country as part of, the pride and identity, but wanting to connect with people. They felt and told us very much, and it was heartbreaking to hear. They said, "We feel that the Pacific has forgotten us, and yet we're here in the same ocean."
Yes, yes, totally. Well, you mentioned great pointers there. I have identified what you've been doing in relation to the report. But in terms of next moves, Anna, what is the most urgent need?
I think the most urgent need, and I highlighted that point around the only one Pacific Island Forum member, referring to Kaneki at the UN in September, the most urgent need is that regional solidarity through our governments, through our regional institutions, such as the Pacific Islands Forum and the MSG, should continue to push and ask for neutral arbitration and offer to be and provide the mechanism or a place to facilitate free, fair and just dialogue between the parties in this process.
Well, Anna, that's all the time we have now. But thank you very much for speaking to Pacific Beat here. Good luck on the work that you're doing, and we'll be following this story in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tomas Oleti.
That was Anna Naupa, the People's Mission Head and Pacific Policy and Development Specialist. Now, going back to Papua New Guinea, it was an historical moment, not just for Catholics in Papua New Guinea, but all Papua New Guineans. The canonization of St. Peter Tirot, PNG's first saint, during a special mass at the Vatican last month, was a proud moment for all Melanesians. It was even more special for those who travelled to Rome to witness it firsthand, including the new saint's grandson, who played a prominent role in the ceremony. Belinda Cora reports. Pap Papua New Guineans are still in celebrations following the declaration of their new saint, who was canonized by Pope Leo at the Vatican last month. Saint Peter Torot died in 1945, but his grandson, Peter Torot Senat, was present at the Vatican to participate in this much talked about canonization of his grandfather.
I participated in the offering of the incense to the relics of the saints. My brother and a PNG nun working in Spain were involved in the offertory, and Sister Celine read the prayer of the faithful. It was walking up the stairs to where Pope Leo XIV was sitting during the canonization mass was very honoring, same time very emotional for me. I had a sense of feeling that St. Peter Torot was accompanying me up the steps as his grandson on his final process to be canonized with the other six saints on behalf of PNG Catholics and Christians and people of East New Britain's families of Rakuna, you know, after the 30 years.
For him, the official day of canonization was one that remains emotional yet humbling.
Yes, visiting Vatican is an awesome, inspiring experience. You read about Vatican City, but walking within the grounds itself is a different experience. Vatican is centered on arts and Catholic history, religious history, with highlights including the masterpieces inside the Vatican of St. Peter Basilica. For this year, the portrait of the seven saints hanging on the St. Peter Basilica wall added a separate significance for people visiting Vatican at this time. However, it requires a lot of walking and with tight security around the city.
Other Papua New Guineans featured in the special mass included Cardinal John Ribot and a PNG nun during the prayers of the faithful.
By all behind him.
So they can also follow the way of our Lord Jesus, who also became a servant, and that they too will hear the words of God with good deeds and thoughts and great passion to follow the call of and life of our Lord.
Saint Peter Torot was a Catholic layman during World War II who continued his role as a catechist among his village people despite opposition by the Japanese soldiers. He was known for his love for the Catholic faith and his passion in serving his people. In 1945, he was arrested and martyred for opposing polygamy following an order executed by the Japanese authorities that wanted to reintroduce the practice. His defense of Christian marriage and morality cost him his life at just 33 years old. Antonia Voigt is from St. Peter Torot's Catholic Church in Rabaul.
What I would like people, the Christians or the Catholic faithful in Papua New Guinea, to see what he did. He died because of he was defending the sacrament of matrimony. And as a Catholic faithful, everyone in PNG should look at his life and, like we say, follow his methodology. Being a simple person from Rakunai, a villager in the village, he became a saint in his own village. He didn't go out. The little activity that he was doing was just to follow what Christ has assigned us or told us to do. He is an example.
Also in the crowd at the Vatican was Dorothy Pion from Port Moresby.
I don't know how to voice it, but yeah, we were emotional. We were crying. We had tears. I felt humble, actually, knowing how far the faith in PNG has come through, like for people like him to show us how it's like. He wasn't a religious person or a priest. He was just somebody just like us who became a saint. So I had, I was crying, thinking of his journey. Awestruck, and there was a sense of spiritual connection.
Dorothy says Torot and his commitment to marriage are an inspiration to her.
In this time when we have people not respecting their wives and husbands, getting, I hear a lot of O2s, O3, O2 Blongem, O3 Blongem, and people not respecting the sanctity of marriage. And this is the seedbed of society where we bring forth children, where children should be taught manners. Because of this decay in marriage and family values, we are seeing all these problems arise.
Fortress,
that was Belinda Cora with that report.
Kick off your Sunday with Kuntamari Crofts on Pacific Sundays, right here on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Sundays is a laid-back weekly wrap of all things Pacific, from news, sport, and entertainment to the best island music vibes. So whether you're chilling out, heading off to church, or catching up with family, be entertained as you do it with Pacific Sundays. Every Sunday at 6 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
The rallying cry to Samoa's players around the world appears to have worked, with some of their best making themselves available for the do-or-die Rugby World Cup qualifying tournament in Dubai. Three matches over 10 days would decide whether Manu Samoa missed the World Cup for the first time since their debut appearances back in 1991 or not. Samoa could have sealed their place with a win over Chile last month, but a weakening team failed to pass that test. And it was that result which prompted former captain Filippo Levi to make a personal appeal ahead of the team's last chance mission.
It's a call out to all of you. Our Samoa people are waiting for you to make yourself available. If you have problems, just leave it alone. Don't worry. Okay, just put the team first. I know it's hard. I'm sure if you put the team together, the game plan, focus, we'll get the results.
And some big names have turned up in Dubai, so Levy's social media posts may have pricked a few consciences, but he's modest about any influence he may have had on bringing the squad together.
I guess they would have heard the cries of the people. They knew that it's really important to be at the 2027 World Cup. And so I guess they would have had their own chats, group chats with the senior players especially. You know, I have chatted to them online, a couple of them, just to say, you know, wishing them the best and hope you guys are coming back. I'm not the only one, there'll be many others. I'm doing a lot of work behind the scenes, especially Lucky P. Samoa, trying to drive the players to come back.
Some interesting names in the list. Theo McFarlane, the captain, is back, which is obviously great. Scott Seale is apparently going to make his first appearance for the Manu after 74 caps for the Wallabies. Miracle Failangi is also in the side when it was suggested that maybe he wasn't going to play for Samoa again. So those are three positives amongst quite a lot in the squad that's in Dubai.
Scott Seale, that's huge. These tight games, we need experience at tight five, coming against some big packs, Namibia and the like. For Miracle Failangi, yes, you're right, there was a bit of talk about him making himself eligible for the All Blacks. And, you know, I guess I've heard that he wasn't too happy with last year. He wasn't selected in those games. And so I think he may have spoken to someone about coming back, or maybe his parents, or maybe his family has influenced his decision to make himself eligible. So he could have went either way. And so it's great to have him. You know, he's one of the form players of Moana Pacifica, and hence why the local players came from Samoa to play in that environment, if that's what the team is for, right?
Now, three matches to be played, starting with Brazil, followed by Namibia, and then the final match will be against Belgium. Only 5 days between each game, so that's a tough schedule for any rugby union player to keep to. But we have Manu Samoa ranked 16, Brazil 32, Namibia 27, Belgium 22. So on paper, at least, Manu should win all the three of these games quite comfortably.
Yeah, of course, they should. Ideally, they should. Looking at the history of these teams, you would probably rank Namibia as probably the toughest opponent, who probably have a lot of players from Currie Cup or players in the top flight in Europe. And I think one of their coaches is a former Springbok. Samoa are the favourites. But you never know. On any given day, it could come down to a last-minute thing or a ref's call or just the team that's just played out of their skin. So we'll see what happens.
Let's hope that the world rankings prove to be accurate. Samoa get the job done over the next 10 days or so, and they go to the World Cup. The players that are out there in Dubai right now, I mean, effectively, not only are they playing for their country to get them to the World Cup, but they're committing themselves to be available for the World Cup. And that surely has to be encouraging.
You've got a saying in rugby where one circle is never the same. So when you're in arms locked with your teammates, you know, we look around and say, this is probably the last time we'll be together like this. So those players who made themselves available now, that's awesome. But that's not to say that they'll be there in the next 2 years. It comes down to players with, you know, with form, the coach's strategy. You're hearing the likes of Manu Tuilangi. He will be eligible. He could come across, which would be wonderful because he'll be just mid-30s. And so, yeah, so there's going to be players making themselves eligible.
In the end, though, it comes back to player development on the islands, doesn't it? Because ultimately, the route for players to follow in terms of heritage is going to dry up.
You've got to have a balance between being locals who haven't been developed as far as those who've been developed in Australia or New Zealand with the systems in place. And so that's why Moana Pacifica has been created. I get the likes of Miracle Failangi, who was seen playing in the club and also playing for the representative teams in Samoa, and he was picked. So pathways need to be, you know, that needs to be sustained. And one of the reasons why that team is there, Moana Pacifica, so to develop that from the grassroots up in Manu Samoa is a challenge, because a lot of the boys will be picked up overseas at a young age, like Fiji and Tonga, who go to France and go to Japan quite young. So Samoa has got a long way to go.
Okay, but with the three games to come over the next 10 days, you're quietly confident that the alarm bells won't need to start ringing?
Well, they've just got to win. They've turned up. They've turned up to play. Now they've just got to action it, come together, use everything they have, all the expertise, use the same way of playing. And we've got enough experience in that team, got enough firepower. We should be able to get through this quite convincingly. And I'm pretty confident that will happen.
That was former Manu Samoa captain Filippo Levi talking to Richard Ewood. And the Manu's opening match of the final World Cup qualifying series will be against Brazil, with the kickoff at 2 a.m. on Sunday morning, Apia time. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, Samoa police have announced no permits will be issued for pre-games parade ahead of Pacific Championship finals between Samoa and New Zealand.
There's no reason permits should be denied. Parades are how our people show support for Toa Samoa ahead of their upcoming game.
If Toa Samoa wins, I'll join and support any parade, even if it's banned by police.
We'll be back at the same time Monday. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon, 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, because news is next. And coming up after that is Nisha Daily. I'm Marianne Gopal, coming to you from the Kingdom of Aotearoa. Have a great weekend.